But I'm very pleased to have this student-led but very diverse audience at this very important talk. I assure you we did not, I don't think Professor Banerjee picked the title knowing what was going to happen in Karnataka, but it seems to be a very good question to be asking for various reasons. So the one you gave us initially, the one we advertised, was even more provocative. But no doubt
you'll
that's
see why
part of
I was,
it.
Why
it,
I
it.
Will
so as many of you know, Professor Abhijit Banerjee is that Andrew Whitehead, who's been was at the BBC, World Service for many years, covering South Asia and has written books himself. Professor Abhijit Banerjee's areas of research, as many of you know, has been economic theory, but also development economics. And together with colleagues, he instituted JPAL, the Abdul Latif Jamil Poverty Action Lab, which in 2003, which many of us have then followed the work, a very active website, and then most recently the book for economics, which I think a lot of non-economists also read and was awarded the Goldman Sachs Business Book of the Year. You also made a film called Name of the Disease, which we haven't seen, but we should screen sometime in 2006. And there are many accomplishments. I think on Professor Banerjee's resume, but I think for the purposes of this talk also, it is important that this is an area of overlapping policy. In 2015, he served as the UN Secretary General's high-level panel of eminent persons on the post-2015 development agenda. So today we are going to hear about why doesn't India's democracy deliver more. We have plenty of time for questions afterwards, as you can see from the schedule. It just remains for me to welcome you very warmly to LSE and to the South Asia Center.
Thank you for having me. Let me see. I'm so used to standing when I speak,
stand.
So if I don't manage, I'll try to sit, but it doesn't come naturally to me. So I changed the title, and I changed the title with a particular reason, which is that I don't want to take on too much. And one of the things I don't want to take on is the very depressing stuff that's happening right now. For a variety of reasons, including the fact that I don't have anything particularly novel to say about it, other than it's awful. And, I think that there are various versions of awful going on right now. A certain amount of majoritarian oppression, I would say, which borders on undermining democracy. Also, in the state where I grew up in West Bengal, you may not have followed this, but there was a recent local election, and what happened in the recent local election was that in a third of the seats, the opposition was not allowed to put in candidates. So this is not the BJP who is doing it. This is the Trinamool, which is the ruling body in West Bengal, which didn't allow a third of the seats to be competed. So, there's a level of, I think, cynicism about democracy, which I find very troubling. I don't have anything particularly specific to say about it, though we can talk about it at the end. I would like to stick to what I do have some specific things to say about. So I'm going to stick to a narrower question, which is, we have very competitive elections, among the most competitive in the world. Elections are often won by 0.1% of votes or less. We are among the world's most competitive elections. I don't think these elections are mostly rigged, with this exception I just mentioned, when nobody was allowed to even allowed to file for candidacy. Mostly elections are, I would say, Free and fair is a very loaded term, but they are relatively free and relatively fair. This is actually an improvement. The thing, elections were worse in the 80s and improved over time. And if you can sort of see little markers of that in the data. It's very expensive to win an election to the national parliament. There are different estimates of how much money gets spent. It's all supposed to be entirely free, so therefore nobody ever can, there's no legal estimate of the amount of money spent. But the kind of non-legal estimates go up to, you know, 100 million rupees. So between $1.5 and $2 million get spent to win. So we're talking about very large amounts of money being spent to win elections. The money is supposed to be your private money. It's not always, but it's and it takes. I've once or twice been on the with people who were campaigning for seats and spent a day with them, and it's harrowing. It's you know, I'm a development economist. I'm used to being in kind of in the field, spending, you know, hot days. But these are very long hot days. I remember a day in Andhra Pradesh where we were waiting at midnight for the candidate to arrive, and so he was. He started at, I'm sure, at 6 or 7, and he would campaign till 2 or 3 a.m. And you do that for months. So this is extraordinarily, there's a lot of effort that goes into winning elections. So I say that because it's important to sort of contrast that with what I'll show you in a bit, which is that they don't seem to respond very strongly to those incentives ahead of the election. So during, in election time, people work very, very hard. But, you know, why not just do a wonderful job and win the election hands down and sleep while your opponent is, you know, campaigning all the time, but he's done nothing and you've done a lot and so you're going to win. That would seem like an alternative model. And we don't see much of that. We see very competitive elections, but as I'm going to show you in a bit, relatively little effect of incentives ahead of time. And that's sort of the fundamental paradox of I would say of Indian politics is that it's God's will and stay home, in which case you don't have to campaign and you don't have to do anything. It's all God's will. But that's not what we see. We see people trying very hard to win elections, but only at election time. Rest of the time, they seem to be taking it, at least not focusing on obviously election-winning outcomes. Now, I'll try to convince you that these two pieces are right, and I'll speculate a little bit at the end about what could be explaining this. But what I want to do is establish these two, the claim that, in fact, they don't respond very much to incentives. So that's the narrow question I want to. So that's why the title. So this is sort of very much kind of big picture background. We see the government sector is mostly, I think, at a point of maybe negative inflection, in the sense that you see suddenly the government schools are emptying out, the places where they have no one, literally, and so you have a process of people were moving slowly to private schools, and suddenly they're moving in droves to private schools, and along with that, there is the data that in all schools, private and public, test scores are extraordinarily low. More than half of fifth graders cannot do second grade math. And for till at least till 2016, falling every year. 2009 to 2016, it falls. My friend Madhav Chavan, who started the NGO Pratham, claims that this is a result of the Right to Education Act, that as soon as it got, the people got the right to education, they were done, and therefore the education was, you can either have the right or you can have education, but I don't know whether that's, that's the right answer. I'll leave that there. Healthcare, which is another place where you see extraordinarily extraordinary amount of exit from the government sector. 80% of all visits in many states are to private practitioners. Most of those practitioners are not actually licensed to practice healthcare. Mukulika mentioned the film we made many years ago, which was all about these fun guys who practice healthcare, and one of them very charmingly explained to us that, well, you know, after I graduated from high school, I couldn't find a job, so I became a doctor. There's lots of people. We have those on camera. He's not shy in explaining this. So, in any case, this goes with there is now a bunch of studies of government doctors, and what they do is they send fake patients to them and see if they can diagnose conditions. And roughly, the difference between fully trained government doctors working as government doctors and private practitioners is tiny. Private untrained practitioners is tiny. So why do I say all this? Social transfers, lots of leakage, poor targeting. Why do I say all these things? Because it's easy to make improvements. It's not that if we had perfection, then I can see why, you know, you can't improve on perfection, so you're kind of stuck. But this is not the landscape in India. So we in principle, and I'll give you some quite specific instances in a minute, the possibility of making things better is not remote. It's sort of within reach, and that should be what you should think about, because it makes the problem more interesting. Is that, you know, it's not so hard to get make progress. Why don't we make progress? So I think there are three parts of this. One part I'm not going to talk about, which is implementation failures, which are a separate subject. Actually, a lot of my work is on that particular issue, but I will actually not talk about it today, because it's the one that is more connected to the bureaucracy, and I don't want to talk about the bureaucracy. But there are two other pieces, I think, which are important, and I'm going to spend a little bit of time on the first one and then talk about the second one. First one is what I would call failure by design. And the failure by design is the idea that democracy actually sometimes is the problem. Or it's not necessarily the problem, it's the reason why there is a failure. It may not be the problem, it might be perfectly, once you think about it, it might be a desirable choice, but it's a failure that's a result of democracy. Let me give a couple of examples. One thing that, for example, the transfer programs are, in India, one thing that was a clear and important decision was to place the transfer programs in the hands of local governments, meaning village level, or it's not quite village, but what we call panchayats, which is the lowest level of government, which are essentially a few villages. They run all rural social programs. Most of them are run through the panchayats. Now, that's not obvious, right? Many, many other countries, these are run by central ministries through their bureaucracies. In India, we made a deliberate choice when these programs were designed to have them implemented through the local system of governance. And it's a choice that I think has important trade-offs. One is that, you know, as a result, you create potentially people who have experience in governance. which is an important part of building a state, is that you have more people. It's not just a few people at the top. There's lots of jobs. Those people can, in principle, move up. So it creates opportunities for performing. It creates a particular form of empowerment. In the village, there are people who feel that, you know, I'm taking important decisions, and that I think gives substance to the word democracy. So these are important choices. On the other hand, it creates a bunch of inefficiencies, which you may also care about. For example, there's lots of data suggesting that the fact that there's a very weak correlation between how many people want jobs under the workfare program and how many people get it. 35% get it in Bihar is a number that I've seen. Why does that happen? Well, because in a sense, the two pieces to this empowering the local democracy that make it harder to be responsive to people's needs. One is that it depends very much on whether the person who's running the local government is actually particularly, energetic or not. And, we are talking about 600,000 villages, and so you could imagine a lot of them don't have energetic leaders, and if they're not energetic, they're just not interested, they're making money and they're going to exit after the next election. You'll see that that's a problem, in fact. I'll come back to this at the end, but so they're just planning to, I won the election, I'm done. I'm going to now enjoy the rents, and at the end of 5 years, I'm going to lose and I'm going to leave. But I'll make enough money in the process. So that would clearly create, obviously, a situation where the local government doesn't deliver. So one reason why there is, as I said, a lack of correlation between demand for these jobs and the supply is because simply the local governments, many of them are just not responsive. That's one reason. The second reason is, again, slightly more complex, which is that partly because the state has given this power over to these local figures, but it wants to keep control over the process so that the budgets are whatever, legitimate, etc. You have to get funds to run the workfare program. You have to apply ahead of time. You have to propose a set of projects. Those projects have to be approved. The budget has to be approved. It's only then you can run it. So suppose you were not expecting a drought, and then you have a drought. There's no way the program by design is unable to respond to it. Because you have, you have to propose the programs in April to get the money in July. July is when you find out when the monsoon failed. At that point, you're stuck. There's no conceivable way you're going to be able to get the money quickly. So there's both, I think the lack of responsiveness is partly institutional. So I it's not blaming individuals. It's we want to control the fact that they are, we make sure that they are not just pocketing the money, so we want them to propose something we can review. That process takes time. Given that it takes time, it becomes therefore harder for them to immediately, when there's a need, to propose a project and get money. So I think in other words, a lot of this is by design. The fact that there's democratic failure is we have made a set of choices. We've decided that the village will run it. This is not, for example, the forebear of the workfare program was a Maharashtra Rural Employment Guarantee Program. That's the idea of the program comes from that particular program. That particular program was run by the district magistrate, who could decide if there is to start camps the day after. He hears there is a drought. That's something the village government cannot do. I'm not at all saying that having sort of local control is not a good thing, but we have made a set of choices here which make the local control, it has its advantages, but also you could imagine it has its obvious disadvantages. For example, a lot of people end up starving as a result of that. I just want to make it clear that these are choices we make as a state. Another one I'll talk a little bit more about is because there is a complex and interesting system of reservations. There are lots of good reasons for reserving seats for A, women, B, people from disadvantaged backgrounds. Nevertheless, it creates huge anti-incumbency, meaning most incumbents cannot rerun. A majority of incumbents cannot rerun. So therefore, if you worry that, you know, I have to show performance, that's the incentive, well, most of them, even if you show performance, you may not get, you don't get a chance to rerun. So there is a, and I absolutely not implying that the reservations are undesirable. There's actually lots of evidence showing that the reservations have good consequences. I am implying that we have to face up to the fact that our design of democracy is consequential. That it's not just that it's all, everything we do is sort of good. Good. We by design, we also create the incentives. And so just that's the point that I want you to take away from this is simply that there are ways in which we make choices in how our democracy is organized, and those choices have consequences for how many of the other desiderata of democracy get served. Okay. So that's just general point I want to make, and then move away from this question of design. So, but let me give one more example. The voters absolutely love access to whatever medications they can get. We have tried to work with governments to ban medications, access to medications. As I said, one of the things I worked on many years ago, from which this film was made, was on access to healthcare. And the problem is clearly too much access to healthcare in a certain very perverse sense, which is that you can go to the village grocery store and buy steroids. And I kid you not. I've tried it because people said you could do it. So you can buy steroids in the village grocery store. So, you know, that's, now, is that politically, when you ask governments, why don't you ban this? You can just send some, we tried to argue the Rajasthan government, which I many years ago I worked closely with, would say, why don't you send somebody to be a mystery shopper? You go there and you say that, you know, give me the steroid, and as soon as they give it, you shut down the store. I mean, this is completely, you know, it's insane to be selling steroids by the, one of the things that, for example, one of the reasons women buy steroids, late teen women buy steroids, because steroids lead to putting on weight. And they are, the women who feel they are too thin to get married or something, often buy steroids because steroids lead the body to absorb more water, and that makes them put on weight. You can also see the symptoms of that because the neck becomes thicker. So there were these village stores which were selling steroids as, they won't call them steroids, of course, they were medicine to make you look more beautiful. Okay. Now, this is a challenge for democracy. Democracy has to decide whether this is popular, but, you know, does the government want to take it on? I just to frame the question of, you know, we have to make a certain set of choices, and democracy faces a certain set of tensions. I just want to leave that thought with you. Okay, so let me now move on to the other part of what I want. How long do you want me to speak? Another half hour?
Yeah, half an hour.
Shall I can go all the way till, I don't know.
3 o'clock?
3 o'clock?
To 5 past.
Five past three.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me go to the other part of what I have. And this is sort of more where I have maybe data to share with you. So, what are reasons why, given that, what are possible reasons why, you know, the electoral system, which, as I said, is very competitive, why doesn't it provide incentives? That's the question I framed at the beginning. You know, if winning elections is so important and people so much put so much effort into it, why don't? Well, one argument is ethnocentrism, that people simply vote for people from their own group. So at the margin, I really don't have much of a say. I mean, what I do doesn't matter. What matters is who I am. And in that extreme case, obviously, there's no point. There are no incentives in that world where all that matters is who I am. I can't change who I am, therefore I cannot influence. Now, I don't think that that's where we are, but I do think there is some evidence for this particular, the fact that people, that you sort of, that the wrong candidates win because of this. Let me explain what the evidence is. So this is something, a fact, it's a well-known fact, which is between 1980 and 1996 in the state of UP, there's a huge change in voting patterns. So if you look at districts where the low caste population share was below 50%, in 1980, there was no difference between those areas in what is a fraction of non-low caste legislators they elected. So where low caste, if those of you are familiar with India, I'm going to say the other backward caste, the scheduled caste and the scheduled tribes, I'm going to call them low caste, and the others non-low caste. That's still a large range of caste. And if you look at the caste identity of the legislator, in 1980, there's no correlation. So you, in fact, it goes the other way. You can see that the ones where there are more low caste, those places are places where 80% of the legislators were not from the low caste. In 1996, that's very sharply different. So in the high low caste areas, there are only 30% of non-low caste legislators, and in the other areas, there is 60%. So you see a big shift in the politics. This is well known. And this was a result of the rise of two low-caste parties, the BSP and the SP. So this is very well-known history. Many people have written about it. What we're going to look at is something else, which is what does this do at the level of the candidate? And with the data we have, which is interesting, we interviewed a bunch. So for every one of these years, if you have data from 69 as well, I'm not going to tell you about it because it's not that different from 80. What we did was we interviewed local journalists and local politicians on different legislators and people who ran for elections. So we said, is X, what do you think of X on different dimensions? And particularly on things like corruption. So we asked a lot of people. So we have a data which is constituency by constituency, the top three candidates, typically we know something about the perception of their honesty. And I think perception is probably the right variable, because after all, people, true honesty, who knows? But at least who was perceived to be, you know, he started, we asked questions like, did he start as a low-income person and end up as a high-income person? Did his family start a lot of businesses during this? So we have a data set, quite rich data set of many, many questions of this kind. So for every, so lots and lots of legislators across all the constituencies, not all, but a large fraction of the constituencies, we have the, sort of measures of their corruption. So let me, it's actually interesting. I could spend the whole time telling you about measuring corruption. It is fascinating. But but assume that I have a decent measure, many, many actually measures, and they all line up in very much the same way. So what does sort of ethnocentrism say? And so ethnocentrism says that basically, if I am in an area where I am a majority, my group is a majority, I'm going to get a discount on quality. Meaning, even if I'm a bit of a crook, they'll forgive me. because I'm theirs, or I when I steal money, I share it with them, or for whatever reason, they're going to be forgiving of me. One implication of that is that if the population was divided, very divided, some places have only high caste and some people have only low caste, then you would get very bad set of candidates, because you know I don't have to be particularly honest to win, because I'm getting this discount because I happen to be from the right ethnic group. So think of a world like that, where people get discounts because so they don't have to perform, they can just steal money. Okay, so now what that implies is that if I look at the places where the two groups are roughly the same sized, there you don't get much of an advantage from being a bad guy. Being from the right ethnicity. There are two groups and they're roughly the same size. Therefore, in those areas, we should not, this doesn't help you in any way. So what happened in between 1980 and 1996 is ethnic preferences were sharpened. People became much more ethnic. So what should happen is places which are unbalanced should see a large increase in the quality, let's say the last decrease in the quality of the majority winner, a large increase in the quality of the minority winner. To win in a particular place where you are a minority, in a very polarized environment, you have to be very good. And in places which are in the middle, we should see no change. Because those are the places where essentially you are still competing. You have to still have to please. Both groups are equal sized. If you're much worse than the other guy, you're going to lose. Okay? So this is what the picture looks like. This is change in winner quality for non-low caste winners as a function of the share of low caste. So when very low caste are very high, which is over here, you see that the quality of the non-low caste winner is actually going up. This number is negative. Okay? The quality is good. Here, the quality is going down, and here is in the middle, nothing changes. This is exactly what the story I was telling, which is that, you know, to win where you are a minority, in a polarized environment, you have to be good. To be win where you're a majority, you have to. It's very easy for you, so even bad guys can win. And in the middle, nothing changes. So that's sort of some evidence, not necessarily totally watertight, but pretty. I think there's a lot of this kind of evidence suggesting that we get exactly the pattern you would expect from a certain kind of ethnocentric politics. So I think that this is important. And worth keeping in mind. However, I want to now, I don't want to leave you with the impression that this is sort of the end of the story, because this would be a depressing end, you know. And I think this is what the BJP in India would like to transform India into, a completely ethnocentric country where there are some. If they could, since Hindus are a majority, if they could turn it into essentially a census on religion, they would always win. So that's what they're trying. So this is very much so. I don't think this is. I think anybody who's familiar with India will recognize that this is an issue that is completely there. That there is a lot of. You know, you can see where in this Karnataka election that was just finished, you can see where the BJP won, the places where they campaigned very strongly on ethnicity. Okay. However, here's an interesting counterpoint to that. I say this because, I'm going to use it to make two points. But so first, this was a randomized control trial. So different places, some places were chosen at random to get a particular campaign, other places didn't. This was done across 867 villages in 18 jurisdictions. So within each jurisdiction, we randomly chose some villages to get this campaign and others not. And then we can track how they voted in the UP state elections of 2007. And local NGO did the campaigns. The campaign did not say don't vote for corrupt people. It just said, or it didn't say anything about parties. It said just vote on issues, not on caste. And it was extremely careful to say just that, because the NGO's view was that, look, we have to live here. If we say X party is bad, we'll be dead. So let's, literally or otherwise, but at least it's dangerous to do that. So we have to survive. So we can say something entirely bland, which is do good things, vote on issues, not on caste. So we were not necessarily convinced that this would do anything. What we find is sort of interesting and maybe half. So you see a 7 percentage points reduction in the outcome. I choose the caste preferred candidate. So if you are from a caste, your upper caste, you chose the upper caste party or something. That number went down by 7 percentage points. When you just said this something completely bland, you were not saying don't do this or don't do that, you were saying something completely bland. Unfortunately, what that second line in that table says, or anybody who wants to read the table, I'll tell you what it says. It says that it doesn't matter whether the person who was... This didn't increase the vote share of the good guys. It changed the vote share. So you started voting for somebody else, but you didn't necessarily vote for the good guys. You just voted for somebody else. So in other words, it says two things. One, it says that at least at this point, and this is what our ruling party is trying to undo, that the ethnic preference was weak. What do I mean by weak? I mean, one form of ethnic preference is simply saying, look, I don't know anything about these candidates, but this one has the same name as me. I might as well vote for them. That's why Mukulika invited me. So that's one view. It's a weak preference. You have no very low information setting. You have a fairly weak preference, but the weak preference is it still has consequences, because I still vote, and when I vote, I have to choose somebody. I choose the guy who has the right name. That's sort of what it looks like, because they don't. When they change their mind, they're trying to be responsive, but their theory of who's a good guy to vote for doesn't seem to be very compelling. So we have some, as I said, we also have detailed corruption data on these people, and it's not that these people are less corrupt or have more of a background in doing things, or it just doesn't seem to be the case. So I would say, what this last line says is that they do vote more for people who are good guys. So it's not that they don't vote more for good guys, but the campaign didn't make any difference. So when we say that you don't vote for these people, the people who are at the margin, who switch their votes, don't switch it to the good guys. So one obvious question is, do voters know about the candidate? Maybe they just don't know anything. And one way you get a very ethnocentric environment is simply one where nobody has any information. So what we did in this is another randomized control trial in 10 jurisdictions during the Delhi state elections of 2008, we prepared, worked with an NGO called Satat Nagarik Sangsthan to create report cards for the candidate who was running. The report card had different pieces of information. Did he spend the money? Every candidate in India gets a certain amount of money, 50 million rupees for every year, to spend on his constituency. So he has that money. How did he spend it? Did he spend it? If he spent it, what did he spend it on? And second, did he set up the committees he's supposed to set up? So did he, you know, stay home, or did he actually take the trouble to set up the committee? For example, there's a committee that monitors whether the fair price shops are operating, and he's supposed to be the chair of that committee. So did he set up the committee? If he didn't set up the committee, then maybe he's not that interested in. So, and these were, in particular, the report cards were designed to be of interest to low-income voters. So it was a bit, the emphasis was on, did he set up the fair price committee? That was a choice, but it was also because we felt that the low-income voters are the people who probably don't read the newspaper. If you don't, so these report cards were published in newspapers, I should say, be careful. So they were published in newspapers. A Hindi newspaper called Dainik Hindustan ran two report cards every day over five days. So you have 10 constituencies, you get information on the performance of the incumbent from that. What we are interested in is, does that affect vote share? And the answer is yes, it affects. So what we did was we distributed those newspapers to these voters at their home. So every voter got a newspaper in the low-income neighborhoods. We tracked votes at the polling station associated with that neighborhood, so we can see immediate effects. And we find that indeed you see knowledge improving, and you see that people, if you look at the best performing candidates, the ones who started the committees, they spent the money in slums rather than on parks and decorative lights, which tend to be in rich neighborhoods, then those candidates gain 7 percentage point more vote. That's a huge amount, given that that's much bigger than the difference between winning and losing. So you do get big effects on once you give information to people, voters do. So in that sense, it sort of confirms that maybe voters don't have enough information, and that's why one of the reasons why we have democratic failure is just because voters don't really know what their candidates are doing. Most of them, if you talk to them, they say, well, you know, I haven't seen him, but maybe he goes elsewhere. After all, one of the problems in India, and maybe we come back to this at the when we have a discussion, is that the constituencies are huge. In India has less parliamentary constituencies than the UK. India has 1.25 billion people. UK has 55 million people. So the order of magnitude is just completely wrong. I mean, India needs to have many, many, many more constituencies. If you think that people are, you know, if you have very, very large constituencies, it's very hard to know what you're doing, because, you know, it's there is so many people in the constituency. Maybe I'm really doing a lot for those other people over there, but, you know, you don't see it. So, you know, and so it's very easy to therefore do nothing, because, you know, there's always so many other places you could be doing something, and you certainly can't cover all the constituency. So if you had a much smaller constituency, then you could be held accountable. You know, all your work is here. I've seen all of it. It sucks. You know, so that's a much easier judgment to make when the constituency is small. When the constituency is as large as it is, it's simply impossible, basically. So that, I think, is a generic concern about India, and it's something to keep in mind. Okay, I'm going to continue because I'm going to run out of time, and don't want you to look at tables right now because it takes too long. Given that we kind of think that, you know, information is weak, and people don't know much, the obvious intervention that this background suggested to us is what happens if we tell the legislators that we will actually give out information about you in 2 years. So people respond to information, and information is scarce, so they, you know, there is some need for it. So could we use it as a way to change their incentives? Could we just say that, look, you know, you can do what you want, but we will, the same report cards we had before, we're going to start publishing them before the elections, and you can decide whether you would perform or not, because you know, we will now, and we randomly chose 170 of them to say what this is in the municipal elections in Delhi. We said, for 170 of you, we will publish in 2012 a report card. The others were told, we had a lottery, and you were not chosen to get a report card. We made it as if this was something that they really should be sad about, but in fact, of course, we knew that that wasn't exactly the case. But we pretended that we were very sorry we couldn't do it. We just don't have the time, because the newspapers won't publish all the report cards. Okay. We also, just to see if... So this is very public. It's information that everybody could see. And therefore, you know, you might see the thing that that's very different from information that I give you, which is just for your own benefit, to make your actions more effective. So the other thing we did was we randomly chose, again, a bunch of constituencies where we audited the public toilets. And that's a horrible thing to have to do, to be honest. If you're going to a public toilet in India at 7 a.m., it's not pleasant. For a variety of reasons, which I won't spend time on, it's, right after lunch. But it's, in any case, it was pretty disgusting. But in any case, we did audits of those, and so we have a detailed description of a bunch of these, and in particular, we geotagged every toilet. We said, you know, here is the broken toilet, here and. We did this, we gave them a report just before the elections. The idea was, let's give them the information, you know, with just enough time to do something about it. So this is not information that voters will use, because the voters didn't get the information. But if you actually use the information to perform, the voters will, also, of course, see it. So this was a facilitating. So one possibility is that, you know, these legislators, they also don't know anything, so they don't know what particular form of performance might help them, so they can't do it. So let's help them by giving them some information. So one thing that is useful to know is that the way the councillors spend the money has very little to do with what the slum households say they want the money spent on. So roads get 54% of the money spent. 2% of the households say that roads is a priority. 16% of the money gets spent on sewage and drainage. 69% of the households want that, etc. You see there's a major divergence between what the voters want and what they get in the baseline. So what happened, and I'm going to not spend time on the table, because again it takes time to read tables. This is a good take. So what happened was, the people who we basically said, you're going to get a report card, and in fact, that was the truth, so they got a report card, do respond. So you see the spending moving quite substantially by, you know, on many things, like, for example, drains, the spending goes up by 50%. So big effects on their spending patterns. Now, since roads is most of what they do, if you cut roads by, I think they cut their road spending by 8 percentage points, so 54 to 46. That pays for lots and lots of other things. So in some sense, it's, you know, they have 8 percentage points less on roads, and that pays, since sewage is very little, it's easy to increase it by 50%. You take 8% and you can spread it across everything else. So the in proportional terms, we see big changes in spending. In absolute terms, relatively little, because all that's really happening is roads are going down from 54 to 46, and everything else is being paid out of that. And this is so, but still, it goes in very much in the right direction. So I want to, and so now, does this have any consequence for the politician? So the fact that they performed, does that help them? The answer turns out to be yes. It helps in a very specific way. The politicians who were roughly half the politicians could not rerun in their constituency because of the various forms of reservation. The reservations rotates, so you cannot, if it's a reserve, you're a man and it's reserved for a woman, you cannot run. So they had to find another place. And what having a report card helped them with was with finding another place. So if you have a bad report card, in the bottom half of the distribution of report cards, your probability of getting a seat in another constituency, if you are not eligible, is zero. If you are, and it goes up enormously if you have a good report card. So they do get rewarded for it. There's some, and so in a sense they're responding to the right things. What's maybe more depressing is that you see nothing at all of those, the private information. So the reason why they're responding to incentives is a bit that this, when it becomes public, it helps them with their public profile. I have somebody walking around showing his report card, basically. Not our report card, actually a newspaper report card that they were showing. So it's something that they understand, and part of them is this is how they campaign for getting this new seat. I'm a very good legislator. Here's my successful report card, etc. So this had consequences, but it had consequences in a very specific way. It changed behavior a little bit. It changed their outcomes a lot because if you have a good report card, you get a much better outcome. When the information is private, so we give them, remember I told you we got information about which toilets are broken, so that's information that we never gave anybody else, so this is information for you to improve your constituency. It had no effect, other than they closed some toilets. So they have a very specific, nothing on anything, I don't want to get too depressed there. So, large incentive effects, but no effect of anything that does not go into public. So what they are responding to it, but they're responding to information that's in the public domain. They're not responding to information that's useful for them, but it's not public. They're interested in their public face, so maybe to influence voters or their parties, but not to influence their... So... Now, let me start closing up, but tell you about one last of these randomized control trials. So this one is interesting because here we decided, look, there's all these information experiments. We're giving people information, we see some. Now, one reason why information might be important is because I didn't know something. Another reason it's important is because it's specific. It makes me think about something. Okay, so if I give you some information, I start asking the question, I know this guy, my local guy, he did this, did he do some other things? And we do, I don't want to spend time on it right now, but we already saw some evidence that they were using information in a way that was partly priming, partly just getting them to think. So here, we did, this was before the village government elections in Rajasthan, and not the current round, but the one before. And they were, it was just street plays. The street play was saying that, you know, this is very important, you should think of who you vote for, because it's, the winner is going to implement the workfare program and NREGA, which is important for your life, and he also will fix the roads, and so you should think of who you vote for. So that was the message in the street play. And then we also gave out, kind of in the part of, as a part of the broader campaign, we told people what was the average number of days of jobs, how much money was spent under NREGA. We gave them no information about their village. So very specifically, we avoided giving any information that's village specific, because we were interested in precisely the question: if I just make you think, do I get a change? And the answer is yes. You start to see very big effects of mostly the bad incumbents don't rerun. So some process happens in the village, new people start running, many new people, typically lower caste people who are well educated. So kind of people who stayed out of the political system probably because they thought that, you know, they didn't have a role in it, but who were prepared for it, well-educated people, started rerunning. So you see substantial effects on that. You see the probability of, you know, rerunning almost more than halves, basically. So and the people who drop out are the bad guys. The ones who didn't spend on NREGA, who didn't create jobs, are the ones who drop out. So you do. Now, what's interesting about this one is that we didn't give them any information. They knew already whether the guy was doing something in their village or not. It's that they didn't know. What this did was they made it discuss that. That changes the entire competition in the village and have very large effects on who's running and who wins, etc. You know, these guys, of course, tried many tricks. They tried to replace themselves by their family member. Mm-hmm. Now, that they did try, but if you look at the effect on who won, they didn't manage. The vote share went down. The bad guy still lost. So you could try to say that, you know, it's not me. It's my daughter-in-law. She's very good. I might not be good, but in the end, the daughter-in-law didn't win either. So, you know, it was very clear that people actually had reacted. Okay. Taken together, there's solid evidence of democratic failure. People vote based on identity. Lack of information about candidates. There is clearly a lack of information about candidates. And perhaps that's why they vote based on identity. But they don't use all the information they have. That's the last experiment. What it clearly shows is they knew who was the bad guy. We didn't tell them. So they knew exactly, and you see only the bad guys get drop out. They know that they're not going to win the election, they drop out, new people start running in their villages. So you see a very clear pattern of people behaving in exactly what you'd hope for, but the information was not planted by us. The information was there already. So in some sense, I think engagement is a huge problem. That people have decided that it's all the same, and once you decide it's all the same, then in a sense, it becomes all the same. If I'm going to vote at random, then nobody should perform. So this is what I was saying, that one possibility is that everybody has low expectations. The voter thinks that he doesn't matter. When I show him that X jobs were created on average across the entire three districts we were working in, they say, oh, well, let me think. My village, did they really create that many jobs? I don't think so. So they got some idea that, you know, maybe this is, you know, my guy is actually worse than So they did get some information from what we said, but the information was less about what their guy was doing than about just benchmarking it. In some sense, you feel like, okay, I don't know, is he doing an okay job or not? I think candidates also might have low expectations. I think this is the really interesting question, is what do candidates think? We have worked with voters a lot, not with candidates enough. But the one thing we tried with them to make it very easy to improve things didn't do anything. So maybe candidates do think it's impossible to improve things. Maybe they're wrong. But we don't see evidence that they respond to. When you make it easy for them, we say, look, this toilet is broken. You are in a position to get someone to go and fix it. Why don't you fix it? They don't seem to respond to that. In that sense, I do feel that maybe they lack the skills. But then, why not at least spend on what voters want? When we tell them that you're going to get a report card, they go from 54% to 46%. 2% of voters wanted roads, so they could have gone to zero as well. They didn't. So somehow you don't see a lot of evidence of responsiveness. The other possibility is that the candidates think that they are, it's just, re-election is kind of a crapshoot. First, there's reservations because 50% of them don't get to rerun. More than 50% don't get to rerun. 47% get to rerun in any case. And then on top of that, it's very top down. I have to please Mr. Modi to rerun the primary. It's everything is controlled by Mr. Shah, Mr. Modi, Mrs. Banerjee, whatever. The particular local leader is someone who really is chooses candidates, and so it's not so useful for me to perform. It's really important to go and make the right noises to the right people, and therefore maybe I shouldn't worry about this performance stuff, because in the end, who picks candidates? The parties, there's no primaries, no local way of articulating demand for candidates, so maybe it's just hopeless for me. When Mr. X came to the constituency, I was busy and I didn't go to pay my respects to him, and now I'm in the black book, and so I'm not going to get, I'm in the blacklist, and I'm not going to ever get a chance. So why bother? So I think there's a lot of that. I think talking to candidates, you feel they feel that they are also powerless, that they don't really control. And maybe they also feel that voters are not going to respond. And maybe they're wrong. Maybe they think voters are. But, if I assume that all voters are going to just say, vote at random, there's no reason to. If voters think all candidates are the same, they should vote at random. And if they are going to vote at random, all the candidates should be the same. There's no reason to do anything. So you could be stuck in an equilibrium where people vote without really thinking about it, and candidates therefore don't do anything. So I don't know which of this is what's going on, but I am out of time and we can stop. It's 3:05.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So we have nearly an hour for discussion, and I'm sure that is thrown up lots of questions, and there will be, I'm sure. I have lots of questions. Let me start with just one. The deficit in democracy that you identified in the first half of the discussion seems to be not really a deficit of democracy at all, but you landed up at a point, I think, where I think that is the correct deficit of democracy, that there hasn't been enough democracy, which is to say that it's been reduced to elections where voters get involved, but political parties themselves are not democratic. So intra-party democracy, internal democracy within political parties through primaries or the selection procedure, needs to be democratized, which simply either hasn't happened, or with the party like the BJP, which actually was a very democratic party, has become less so with the Modi-Shah regime. So that we haven't had enough democracy would be the conclusion. Now, this idea of the first half of your discussion of the villages and the workfare programs and the implementation failures, the design failures. Now, is democracy the culprit, or is it the fact that the design failure was really not that devolving power to the local levels was not mirrored by devolving bureaucracy? So the bureaucratic structures of the Indian state stop at the block level, and the political representational structures go down to the village level. So when panchayat members get a pot of gold to spend, there is no bureaucratic mirror to implement those programs. And this is kind of held out by what you said with the Maharashtra Employment Guarantee Program, where part of the success, one could argue, was precise, as you were indicating yourself, that the DM was in charge. He had the district magistrate has a bureaucratic machinery in operation, which can then actually make things happen. The panchayats simply don't have, the bureaucracy just stops at a level higher than the village at the block level. So that's one thought. I have many more things to say about UP and Rajasthan as well, but I don't want to anticipate all the questions.
So let me start at the end. So strictly not true. There is actually a panchayat, a sachiv, who is one of the few people in the Indian bureaucracy who actually has, in principle, very strong incentives, because he actually doesn't have, he's on a contract, and he's supposed to be exactly the whole concept of the local bureaucracy was that he would be a, now I think that turns out to be a problem rather than a, but I don't think it's quite true that there is no bureaucracy. The sachiv is a bureaucrat.
Yeah, but he can't make things happen on the ground. He can't get roads built in the way that...
His job is to get the roads built. In fact, roads are always built by contractors, but his job is to get the contractor, to get this contract signed, to get the money to him. There is a bureaucracy at the village level. It's simply... We can spend time talking about that, but it doesn't seem to me to be so... I think that you're right in... I'm not disagreeing in this fact that if we were willing to put enough resources on the ground, maybe this thing would work better in the sense that... But I think fundamentally the problem isn't that the problem isn't so much that the panchayat isn't willing to do the job. It's simply, we also have control structures. Control structures mean that essentially whatever it is going to take 3 months to get the money. And that doesn't come from the lack of a bureaucracy. It comes from the fact that we don't want him to take unilateral decisions. And that comes from something else. It comes from the fact that there is almost no, we have no fiscal decentralization. If we had fiscal decentralization, so that there was taxes collected at the village level, stayed in the village, then in principle we don't have to worry about, it's his money, he spends it. One of the problems is that we have all the money is collected at the top and then sent down. And so I don't think the problem is so much that it's that he doesn't have the administrative power, because we see very, very effective panchayats as well. It's more that since the money is far away, his ability to respond to local needs is always mediated by his negotiation with the state. And I think if there was money that was collected at the village, you could imagine much more. I think then he could hire whoever he wants to hire. He doesn't have a budget. That's, I think the real problem is money rather than the lack of a bureaucracy. There is actually, in principle, they had thought of that.
But the state is very remote.
No, but
right? The state needs to come down.
In general, I'm entirely with you on that. I'm just saying that there is a specific sense in which I think the primary problem is fiscal, right, rather than rather
capacity.
Than structural. It's not that the bureaucratic structure is wrong, it's the fiscal. The fact that he doesn't collect any money means he's essentially disempowered.
Mm.
I think at some level we never implemented enough local fiscal decentralization.
Mm.
And I think if we did that, then he would have no excuse to not implement, because he would have the money. And I think that would change a lot.
Mm.
And then you could hire whatever diverse people they need. We simply have not created. All the money comes from top to bottom. And therefore, accountability to the top is very important. And therefore, that whole process becomes very slow. Because, you know, I have to send in my proposal 3 months ahead to get the money. On the first part of what you said, I think that I guess I disagree. I don't think it's simply a matter of the political parties. I think you do see, as I said, people don't have information, they don't use information, they are often disengaged, and I think voters are part of the problem, and I don't think that we have created the structures which make voters particularly engaged. And I think we have done some, in fact, I think some of our choices make the voters disengaged. And I want to come back to the point I was making about our constituencies being too large. I think this is really a fundamental problem, that you know, you have such enormous, I mean, constituencies that there is no sense in which I can be really responsive. So I feel, look, you know, whatever it is a crapshoot. I really might as well spend my time, you know, toadying up to Mr. Modi or whoever will I need to toady up to, rather than do anything for the voters, because my constituency is enormous. If I'm an MP, a member of the parliament, it's just impossible to really have much of an impact. So I might as well just go and, you know, spend my time, you know, cheering Mr. Modi. I mean, that's just a much cheaper way to get influence. So I do think that we have created a set of structures which make voters very hard to engage voters, especially in the parliamentary elections. It's just, performance is just not going to be an important part of it. Second, we have very little, for example, the states almost don't legislate. We have a legislative assembly in every state, but states don't actually legislate. Laws are all made kind of, and so if you think of what the legislators are supposed to do, which is to sort of pass local bills of different kinds, you see here occasionally somebody did it. When you hear that, you know, somebody did this, there was this, for example, there was a set of extremely, let's say, fraudulent universities were set up because the state of Chhattisgarh suddenly gave them permission. Why did the state of Chhattisgarh give them permission? Because somebody introduced a private member bill while everybody else was sleeping in the legislature of Chhattisgarh, which is a sleepy state, and got it passed. And they were setting up universities right and left, who were all headquartered in Chhattisgarh. Why? Because under Chhattisgarh Act, you could set up universities without any regulation, essentially. So, I mean, the state legislation is more a loophole than anything else. And that creates a huge problem, because it, again, if I want to, you know, my legislator do something, well, one of the things they can do is they can create good rules, and they could advertise that. But there's no legislation done in state assemblies, and that's a huge challenge for democracy to be effective. So it's not simply that the political parties; it's the entire structure of the way we've implemented democracy is a problem.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much it challenges your assumptions, but I think as you go up, I mean, beyond above the panchayat level, it looks like the incentives that you have are different. And so you have, you know, on the one hand, voters at the national level, for instance, being much more strategic in their voting, and kind of the incumbency waves are not motivated by say, for instance, reservations, as you put it. And then at the same time, if you were to look at from the which you have hinted at, the information asymmetry that politicians have about their constituents, I think there's an element of especially with PJP, that you have this kind of cadre-based party where that would be the case, but many other parties don't have that, and so the politicians are completely paranoid about their voters. They don't know what the voters want. They know that the performance, as far as what they do in the legislative body, it makes no difference. So they kind of focus a lot trying to be liked, and trust becomes an issue for a motivating factor. So if that's the case, then you have kind of this kind of three-tier, and the incentive structures are very different at the top level versus at the panchayat level, then wouldn't that also affect the delivery of public service that you have? And so at one level, those things matter, but then at the national level, it would be a completely different set of motivations. And so how can you mix those two kind of contrasting or inverted type of incentives and the natural matter at the national level or the local. It's kind of a strange question, but I think that the...
I think it's a perfectly fair question. I think it's absolutely true, and I think I already hinted at part of the big difference is that the national constituencies are too big, and they're too big in a way that is sort of makes the whole competitive idea that we're going to show performance infeasible. So I think that's completely true. What I do think is also true is that, so having said that, I think some of the general point I want to make is in a sense encompassing those, which is that I think we it's a set of design choices we have made, which have consequences for how effective our democracy is. And in that sense, I think that, yes, you give the example of, how do politicians know anything? I don't know so many politicians, but some I know quite well. My father's uncle was a member of parliament, and when I would stay with him, basically the one thing he did was constituents would come, he had a house in Delhi, people would come to his house at 2 a.m., ring the bell and say, I have this problem. So it's not that he was not getting, and one thing he would always do is his front room was entirely for anybody who comes, sleeps there for 3 days or whatever, and he may or may not have, I'm not saying he was a particularly effective politician, I have no idea, but I am saying that he was unfailingly polite to them, and he would let them sleep. There was a constant production of food to give them something to eat, so that they didn't, and so there was a. It's not that. So I think there is a fair amount of interchange, even if you are a member of parliament. So it's not that you need your cadres only. People come because they feel that you have power, and they come and tell you what their problems are. And if you, I don't feel that they are as such, if they wanted to get information, they couldn't get it. I think maybe at the village level, an MP can't possibly get the information. Too many villages in his constituency. There's 1,000 villages in every constituency, roughly. That's too many, and he can't get it. But is it the case that, for example, there's so for an MP, I wouldn't do the kind of experiments I described. I wouldn't do it. But was there a response to a drought in his district? Does an MP find out about a drought? The answer is yes, for sure. Somebody's coming to his house and says, this is real. And does he respond to it? I think you could measure it. You could see if the spending in that district actually went up. There are special drought funds that the government actually has. Mm-hmm. So did those funds get spent? That's a measure of something that you could find out. And I think that my guess would be that that's something nobody knows. And that if this was a public piece of information and that this was something that you were evaluated on, you might be a little more responsive to it. So I am not as pessimistic as you are. I do think that the key pieces of information arrive. And for MP, that's, is there a drought? Or is there a disease which is killing all the potatoes, like there was, I think, 2 years ago? Something like that is will come to you. And if it comes to you, you have the instruments to act. Whether you act or not is still a choice.
Okay, let's take, I know there'll be lots of questions. So I'm going to take two together. You and then you.
Thank you.
And please keep them short.
Thank you, really thought-provoking talk. My question is about, so information is a big part of the story, right? So in your experimental setup, you have two sets of actors. You have the voter and the politicians and political parties. So the question is, who provides the information? In a well-functioning democracy, it would be the civil society, right? In your experimental setup, is the scholars from MIT who come in and provide these reports?
No. That would be insane. There are a bunch of NGOs which do that. So there is plenty of civil society in principle that's supposed to do that. I would never want people to think that. I mean, that would be a dangerous thing to do. We work with a bunch of NGOs. Every state there are NGOs which do that. So civil society institutions exist. Whether they're funded enough, whether they have enough manpower and other things, that varies.
Sure, so that was my question. Is it completely moribund at a rural level?
No, not at all.
So if it's not moribund, why is it then not sort of serving that kind of function? That, because it seems to be not functioning as well as it should be, considering that these NGOs exist.
They have very limited amounts of money. The government has... This government in particular has tried very hard to cut off all sources of funding to anybody who could be dangerous to them. I think these institutions, they have goodwill, they have good people, but that takes you only so far. And then there is some money which you, to do a campaign like this, it takes money. You have to go to a village by village, you have to hire a truck, you have to go there. These things cost money. So I think that it's really... what the government is doing is extremely strategic. They understand that the counterpoint to their cadre-based organization is these NGOs, and they want to destroy them.
Okay.
I want to get back to this question of the information quality and information availability, because you're talking about freelance constituencies. I ran a number some months back, and I think like the median constituency is about the universes, actually, and the smallest things again. And at the same time, you have basically too many candidates in each constituency, so basically each voter is facing a very different calculation trying to figure out like who's going to be the front runner here. I wonder, on top of that, even if you were able to provide better information, all these different. Because you have this interlocking system of different elections, different levels, because they're all unsynced, every single voter is facing this crazy timeline of elections coming up. And if you don't have a list in front of you of the different competencies of each level of governance, it's very difficult to know exactly which politician. Is it one you're voting for now? Is it one you're voting for in the next election, 2 months? Is it one you're voting for in 3 years? Is it actually in charge of school boards? I don't know if that's actually solvable, unless you start
getting into sinking elections. Well, that particular problem is not a problem only, I mean, India has less of it than the US. The US has like elections for, you know, the person who's going to shave you. Like they have like alderman, this, that, and the other. Every week there's an election in the US. So, the U.S. has dealt with it. The U.S. has, you can see the consequences of that possibly, but I don't think that Mr. Trump is a product of the fact that there are too many elections. I think there's something else that went wrong there. But I think the deeper point you're making is completely right, which is that people don't know which election, who has what job. And so typically the person they think has most power is the legislator for the state assembly. That's the person they think is the... So even for jobs that the local government can do, like in the city, the corporators, they think the corporators are not very useful. They think the legislator is powerful. They go to the legislator. They don't go to the member of parliament either, because that's he's too high up. And so they have a clear theory of who's important. And we see that when we ask them the name of their corporator, the name of the legislator, and they know the name of the legislator much more than the name of the other two. They just know who it is. That's the person who matters. We ask the party of that person. They get it right. So I think there is a confusion about who does what. And they decided that this one person does everything. And in fact, they will go to anyone for any of those things. They think, and the vision of the state is, I think somewhat rightly, that there is an elite who, you know, and they are all interconnected, and you just have need a door to them, and a window to them. You whenever you see them, you blurt out your problem. They even think I'm a member of the elite, and they'll tell me everything about all the problems they need fixed, because they think I could go to someone and tell that. I think I think you're exactly right in saying that that's a huge problem, that we don't have delineation of responsibilities, and therefore again. Since, let's say, if I'm the member of the Legislative Assembly, I can't do very much about droughts. Droughts are kind of a too high-level thing. But I'm held responsible for it. And that might be one of the reasons why you see relatively little incentives. Because I feel like, something bad will happen, and when something bad happens, I'll be blamed for it, and it's not that I can do anything about it. So I take your point. I think it is very important point, which is that it would be very useful for people to know that X does this, Y does this, and Z does this.
Yeah. Can you keep your question short, and we'll take two
answers short as well.
And we'll take two questions together, please. We won't get
anyone. Thank you for the inspiring analysis. So you spoke about a lack of information and a lack of engagement, and the Right to Information Act kind of can be viewed as an enabler to counter those two. Why do you think that has not been
You've
alluded to this slightly, but I wonder if you could comment on differences, sort of urban and rural differences, and the role that urbanization has played in changing democratic behavior.
So let's see.
I think the Rightful Information Act is used a lot. In fact, we did our experiments. We couldn't have done it without the Right Information Act. So it's used a lot. There are, 100,000 petitions in per state or something, some very large number. So it's not used. Part of the problem is its remit is very wide. So the information commissioner is constantly responding. So, for example, if I wanted to know how much, my would-be daughter-in-law's father makes, if he works for the government, I can petition to know his salary. What does the commissioner of agriculture make in the state of Jharkhand? I can petition to know that. So lots of these things, you look at the petitions, they're insane stuff. Like, why should you? You could also look it up on the web. He's X years old, there is a certain schedule, but no. You put in this petition, and that creates noise. So I think in some ways the remit is too wide. And if this was much more about some few specific things, like I think it would be more effective. It's just the volume is huge, and it makes it very difficult to do the job properly.
If anything, one could say the kind of information that you think voters could do more of, you actually don't need RTI for it. It's available. What subject are devolved to the states, for instance, after the night pay commission. That is the finance commission. That's, you don't even need an RTI for this kind of information that you're talking about. Okay. And then the question about urbanization.
So, there are many answers to this question. I think I'll just say one, which is that there is, one way to be, positive about what's happened in rural India is that there is significantly more power in the hands of rural, the lowest level of democracy in rural areas than in urban areas. The 74th Amendment was never implemented. So there is very little power. So whereas at least because they have lots of money, there's some real interest in villages. In cities is much harder, because in cities, in a sense, the cities are totally under the thumbs of the state government. They don't really function as democratic entities as such.
Which is why the voters, if they think that the legislator is actually the most important person, they're not entirely wrong.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, Adnan, and then you, and this. Yeah.
Hi, what do you think about the role of like type versus call it world effort question in terms of political behavior, and also about barriers to entry of politicians?
I think about them. We do have some evidence on the question of. So the question was, is it that politicians are just incapable of doing things? Some politicians are just incapable of doing things, or is it that they're capable but they don't do it? So both could be true in principle. That we're electing nincompoops or just, you know, completely, sort of programmed thieves or something who can't do anything other than steal, and I'm sure there's plenty of people like that. But overall, I think we find that from the voter's point of view, what he evaluates is performance. When we look at characteristics that we can put in, it seems like performance is what matters. Now, we don't put in the characteristics that he's an inveterate thief in there, so I can't tell you exactly the answer. It's a difficult question. I don't know that there is going to be a clean answer to that, because the kind of characteristics that the voter perceives is not necessarily one that I can justify putting into any piece of paper. Some voters think that X is a thief, or he's a, like, for example, in the US, many people believe that Barack Obama was a Kenyan Muslim. What do I put into the regression? That is a Kenyan Muslim? there is a little bit of the challenge in sort of what matters is your perception. So it's hard to know exactly what we could legitimately research on that. But I think it's an interesting question.
Barriers to entry. There's a very interesting study of UP, since you've talked about UP, until is that post-mandalization, post-caste mobilization and caste parties, post-96, the 20 years since, 96 to 2016, if you look at the figures of MLAs represented in the UP Assembly, even though there's been a massive expansion in caste representation, like you said, lower castes being represented in the legislature, if you then look at it by class, it's become about 20 families in all of Uttar Pradesh, which is the largest state in India. So there's been a sort of narrowing of class while there's been a widening of caste. So, that's why the original point about democratization within political parties and barriers to entry there, the fact that you can't enter political parties through competition but through other networks becomes such a serious issue.
I forgot. So I entirely agree. I think the primary barrier to entry is people's love of their children. It's a complete disaster. You see what's happened to the Congress Party, which is used to be India's biggest party, is essentially there were a bunch of ambitious people there, who each of whom basically discovered that they had no chance of being the leader of the party, because they were not from the Nehru family. And as a result, you have Sharad Pawar, you have Chandrasekhar Rao, you have Mamata Banerjee. These are all from the Congress. It's like, there's a whole bunch of them. In a sense, they're all ex-Congress people who have now gone to different parties. I'm going to not remember the other example, but there are a bunch of these people. At some point, I made a list of these people who are all originally Congress people whose parties have exactly Congress ideology. They're sort of centrist parties and who don't, nothing changes other than the fact that now they are outside the Congress because they decided that this was they had a better chance of being the top dog outside the Congress than inside. And this is a complete disaster for the Congress. You know, I even wrote an op-ed once saying, when Rahul Gandhi had proposed that Congress's primaries, I wrote an op-ed saying they should have primaries including anybody else who wants to run. So if you want to, so you don't have to be in the party to run, because you have all the talent. These are some of the most talented politicians in India are outside the Congress because they feel their ambition has no space inside the Congress. And that's a ridiculous situation to be in, especially in these times when we need the Congress. So it's a very, very frightening.
We will take two questions together. I forgot last time.
This is on the benchmark effect that you mentioned for the last system. One way I think to test that is if you look at spending on the deployment program in the subsequent cycle, whoever is elected, if you see a reversion to the mean there. And I was wondering if you tested that, that there are these unintended effects.
So we do.
Should we take another question?
So in fact, we find that the person who's the people who are elected as a result of this,
yeah,
they tend to be worse than,
yeah,
the people they're replacing.
That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah.
Because you might see that they might have been willing to spend more, but because they have this new benchmark, they spend less.
I don't know that. I didn't understand that theory, but I'll hold you to it later.
Okay. And the last thing I wanted to ask is this weak taste for your identity when you vote these ethnocentric preferences. Isn't that perfectly rational? Because it's a kind of quality indicator, especially if you have a lot of ignorance about the other candidates, and you think it's more likely to give you some sort of benefit from voting.
It's perfectly
rational.
Well, I'm not saying it's irrational. I'm just saying that if it might, what makes it rational is precisely the fact that you have no other information. That's what makes it rational, in a sense.
That's one explanation, but also having just returned from Lucknow, where we did a conference on the future of democracy, and right outside the conference venue was Ambedkar Park.
Yes.
Right? I don't know if anyone's seen Ambedkar
yes.
Park. But, and you've seen it.
I went
now,
running there many times.
Correct. I mean, it's a great place to run because it's monumental.
And nothing's there. No one's there.
It's empty, but no, there are statues of Ambedkar,
yeah,
and you suddenly see statues of famous Dalits. Nowhere else in all of India do you see it.
Yeah.
Now, that is a perfectly, to my mind, a rational reason that, you know, identity then doesn't become some sort of irrational, primordial impulse, but to say, yes, we need to occupy and reoccupy the space of the public sphere through an assertion of identity, which would not be possible in any other way, apart from to capture...
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't...
You're not denying that.
I'm not disagreeing with that at all. My point was only that identity does... you look at what's happened... Here's a fact that is really striking. Is if you looked at the Congress vote in... Congress vote from, I think we have data from 67, but let me say 71. 71, essentially the share of the upper caste in the Congress vote is going down like that. The share of the BJP in the upper caste is going up like that. You know, one of the things that's very, very clearly happening is that we are, so it's not simply that the, some of these things might very well be, as you say, identity is valuable in itself, and I don't disagree with that. But I think that the general trend is also towards making that a kind of center for political organization, and that's where the danger lies. The danger lies in...
As we saw with the BSC.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's the woman.
My question was related to sort of disenfranchisement. So in some ways it speaks to, I guess, your point about disengagement and maybe to some extent the issue of identity. But to think about it in a slightly different context, when I think about, let's say, all the issues that are arising with Aadhaar and, you know, how certain, to correct one set of problems, we've made a certain choice, which is now leading to all these other sort of, you know, problems.
essentially being they're finding themselves in a position of being disenfranchised, whereby they are not able to even access, you know, people or legislators or whoever to address these issues at a personal level, at an individual, at a local level. Are you thinking of that also in the context of disengagement, or are there other nuances that potentially this institutional structure is built in terms of your point relating to the design that is actually feeding that separately?
I don't think of disenfranchisement as being a big problem. I think disengagement is a huge problem. Disenfranchisement, because I think one of the things that the state has held the line on pretty well is on, in terms of, you know, what it takes to get a, we ask people if you have a voter identity card, and it's not one of the things on which people say. Now, it might happen that once the government decides that it's going to tighten this, because after all, you know, they're going to say all the Muslims are foreigners, then of course this is going to change. But so far that hasn't happened. So far we ask people, actually, do you have a voter identity card? It doesn't seem to be a problem. It's something that...
Not at all.
It's not a... I mean, that's... I am agreeing. I think it's not yet a problem. The government would love to make it a problem. But we see if they succeed. But there clearly hasn't yet been a problem in my sort of... All the election surveys we do, we ask that question.
I mean, if I just may follow, I mean, again, obviously, I agree as far as the voter ID cards are concerned, but when I think about specific groups, let's say I take the example of women, the whole aspect about women feeling disenfranchised, disconnected, disengaged, is partly to do with the problem, A, that they may not have enough role models, or, you know, and we know from, works within our discipline about how that sort of phases out. But the issue there is also, in some sense, who is, and maybe that speaks to the identity issue, I'm not sure. But the point there is, how does one then actually engage when one is sort of, you know, constantly feeling left out, put on the back burner, on the background, right? And that is the kind of disenfranchisement that is potentially not going to be picked up by asking questions about voter rights.
Absolutely.
Right?
So I would call that disengagement rather. I mean, I rather stick to a slightly narrower definition of disenfranchisement. That's all I was saying. That I think that, you know, many people are disenfranchised in your sense, because it's, I mean, women are, but if you are a Muslim in Gujarat, you are disenfranchised because, you know, you are, where you live is cordoned off, and there's all kinds of things that make disenfranchisement very real. But I was just sticking, I think, I prefer the word disengagement for a reason.
Yeah. Okay, so we have two questions here. Yeah, so go for that.
So I'm going to take us back to a part of the conversation that you were having earlier. Thanks for a really enlightening and insightful discourse here. I was wondering about the problem of decentralized funding, as you were saying, that's one of the main areas. But evidence is showing that there is massive underspends recurrently, even in programs where there are funds allocated to village legislatures to use as they would. You see reports coming back constantly of underspends to the extent of 70% or 80% of the funds not being used.
Yeah.
So I think in a capacity-constrained environment, as is our country, how much do you think then is the value of just having decentralized funding going to fix problems in program implementation or really solve this?
Well, I think I usually don't like arguing by anecdote, but I'll tell you an anecdote which I really feel is very telling. So we have an interview, long interview with a panchayat head in Rajasthan. So and we're talking about corruption and all that. And he says the following. He says, look, you know, if you're an honest, maybe he wasn't honest, I don't know, I have no proof, but let me say I trusted him. If you're an honest panchayat head, you're between a rock and a hard place. Why? Because on one side, if you run a program, half the villagers demand that you should pay them without doing the work. because if you run a program, they say, do you know, the government is giving the money, why would you want to just insist that we actually do the work? And he says that in a public meeting, and he says, and points to them and say, half of you do it, don't you? And they say, there's a lot of the general laughter, and people say, yes, of course. I mean, there's no disagreement on this point. So half of the people, then on the other side, the government now measures the number of cubic feet of earth that's removed, and so you get paid by that. So how do I get the work done? So, you know, I think the fact that the control structure is somewhere else always means that I don't want to spend the money, because spending the money is a headache. He says, actually, you know, running these programs, I would like to do it, but it's such a pain. It's such a complete, it makes my life so unhappy. It makes me so unhappy having to do it. I'm honest. And he says, if I were to steal money, then maybe it'd be worth it. Because, you know, I would be at least be compensated for the effort by, you know, the money I can steal. He says literally that. But if I'm not going to steal money, you know, what pays for this? Well, why would I put in all this effort, which is just a hassle? Because I'm going to, if I don't give the money to those who don't work, they will actually complain to me. So why would I want to take, it's a huge pain dealing with those people who, why don't I, if I don't have a program, I don't have to do anything. So I do feel that the part of the problem is that he is accountable in a way that he couldn't say, look, you know, I have this much money, this is my goal, I'm going to spend it anyway, you know, it's your money, you can decide. They think this money is third party's money, so why would you stop me from getting it? And then it's with his interest versus theirs. It turns it into, because the money is from someone else, it turns it into very much this kind of, it's sarkari money, so therefore I should not, you shouldn't worry about it, just give it to me. I think if it was villagers' money, say you have this budget, you can steal it, but then we won't build the road. And that would actually be much more compelling. I think that this is the fact that these are line funds which you can spend or not spend, and therefore you might as well give it away, it creates very distorted incentives.
But wherever there are these non-line funds, just a quick follow-up on that, especially for the pratham, for the work done in education, you see that whoever is mastering that fund ends up wasting it on, I don't know, building random walls, buying chairs, when there are no students in those schools. So there is an issue of what to do with that money when it is also not tethered to anything and there's no accountability and the onus is on this one person to execute.
Partly because the places where he puts all his effort are already, there is funds for it. So it's not clear to me that there is a sense in which if you gave him a whole budget and said, look, this is the total amount of money, you do decide what you're going to do with it, it may be very different. Because right now, most of his time is devoted to running those programs. If he's a decent administrator, he's running those programs. He doesn't have much time. Now he has some money, what does he do with it? I feel like, you know, if he had a block grant to spend, it would be very different. That's my guess. I don't know. My guess is it will be very different.
I'm wondering how important election campaigns have become. So in this kind of low information environment, what ends up happening is voters kind of have to find some signal. And many Lokniti surveys, for example, have shown that voters actually care about development issues.
Absolutely.
Even campaigns show this, for example.
Yeah.
In 2014 elections, development was
absolutely.
But this also has the unintended consequence of then, you have to raise money for the campaign. And the campaign is so long that, the election commission will then come in and say, well, you can't do much before this. So, this dynamic as well comes into play. So, just wondering what you have to say about that.
So the answer to the question.
The whole problem with election campaigns becoming so salient that they might actually be stopping some sort of better political kind of system to come in within the parties themselves.
So the general point you're making is completely right, that you know, the fact that all the competition is at the electoral level is all bad. That's what I was trying at the beginning, saying at the beginning, that all the competition is during elections, and we want to shift the competition back to where I show performance. But I think the way to get there is to make performance salient. That's the only way we're going to fix that problem. We're going to fix that problem. People will want to win the election. They're going to waste effort. You can't stop them from wasting effort unless somebody says, look, nobody can beat me here because I have done so many things here that, you know, anybody who is sensible will vote for me. So you really need to shift the competition forward towards the when in year 1, 2, and 3, and 4, not in year 5 just before the election.
Okay. A question there. Yes. Quickly, we'll take these three together, otherwise we'll run out of time.
You referred to a campaign where NGOs went out and urged people to vote on merit rather than caste or community lines. And
not merit, actually, on development issues.
Development issues. So, and a certain percentage moved away from their traditional references. Was there a certain weightage given to education when they moved away towards what you call development issues?
We have no idea. Remember, we don't know what. The only thing we observe is the characteristics of the candidate. So if you're asking, do they vote for more educated candidates? The answer is no. We don't see it, but it's not clear to me that that's necessarily the right measure of quality. But we don't see that.
Okay.
Do you think the Congress will have the sense to make Shashi Tharoor prime ministerial candidate rather than Rahul Gandhi?
I'm going to skip that one. He might go to jail soon.
Yeah.
I'm not going to pick him. He's not my top pick for success.
Well, having a court case against you has become de rigueur to be showing at the moment. You're actually qualifying now. He's better qualified than Rahul Gandhi.
Can I just follow up on this question?
I have another question. Quickly.
Yes, do you think if there's other folks other than Rahul Gandhi, Congress has at least some chance of...
I actually think Rahul Gandhi might be their best bet because I think what's going to happen if anybody else comes in is there will be a huge fight right now. And that one thing we don't need before the 2000 election, the 19 election, is a Congress splitting. I absolutely think that right now the best bet is to hold your breath and not worry about those issues. To say that Rahul is the person who's right now in that seat and he's still going to be better than provoking a succession fight. A succession fight in this year is going to be deadly.
And also I think this image of Rahul Gandhi that you're evoking is also the result of a very effective social media campaign. I think everybody should go and watch the press conference he did last week in Karnataka, which is a very, very sane, civilized engagement with issues taken in an open press conference in a way that we haven't seen for 4 years. Anyway, we have another question, a final question.
One thing you didn't touch on in your talk, which at least the sort of popular imagination often associated with Indian politics, is around vote buying. So is it because the evidence shows it's not a big problem for electoral incentives?
I think it is a big problem, but we've sort of been dancing around trying to figure out how big it is. If you look at maybe at the margin for some tight elections it does matter, but if you look at the just predicted what's going to happen, it does pretty well, the prediction model. So I don't think of it as being enormously consequential, but it's hard to know because it may be that they just tipped those 7 elections that went by 500 votes. There is vote buying, We had in Delhi state elections, we posted somebody near the booth the night, two nights, and there was alcohol being distributed and all that. So there is vote buying. Now, whether I also have heard, and I have a nice video from a lady who explains. So we ask her, you know, suppose somebody comes to buy a vote, what do you do? I said, we're going to bring him inside home, we're going to sit him down, speak nicely to him, take whatever he has to give, and then kick him out. And then vote for whoever we want. So I think political parties are also chary of that. I mean, where it works best is more moving voters, which is a form of vote buying that I think, in some ways, I think we should subsidize to all parties. In other words, anybody who wants money for a truck to bring voters, what they do is, if your money is you bring in voters who you know would vote for you but won't come. I think that's something that the way to solve that problem is to actually make public money available. Anybody who wants to voter assistance funding on the day of the election, you can bring them. You can get free trucks to bring people, because I think that actually will even the playing field rather than, so any party which got more than 5% of the vote in the previous election is entitled to free trucks. I think that would be something that I think would be a good idea. I've suggested it, but so far no takers.
Can I just say, in conclusion, having done some research on this and published a book called Why India Votes, I think we should stop calling it vote buying. What it is there's a lot of vote spending, because vote buying implies that you're able to successfully buy votes. Money is spent, and as we just heard, and we gathered this in evidence across India, that elections are bonanza times. You know, so if you don't have much, this is your opportunity to actually get the extra sari and a liter of kerosene and, you know, whatever else is going. Because redistribution doesn't happen enough the rest of the time. This is actually a moment of redistribution, if anything. The second thing to note and respond to the discussion we were having with Sanchari is that, again, you know, a fact that most of us know, but remember, in this discussion of disengagement, it therefore remains a curiosity that voter turnouts keep going up. And women are voting more than men. You know, now in nearly half the states of India, more women vote than men. So that discussion of disengagement that you fleshed out so carefully for us, of, you know, what is it that people are doing with information, does it actually have an impact on feeling like they have a stake in the system? Plus, you know, combined with the fact that when it comes to voting, they are turning up to vote, you know, kind of remains as an important set of questions. And it's fantastic that we have so many people, students interested in Indian politics, who should go and look at this question even more. But thank you, Vijita, very much for a fantastic afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you.